Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 25 plus years of collecting films on obsolete formats. You can also think of this podcast as being about films from the VHS era, or at least that were available in the VHS era, though we don't necessarily always watch them on VHS. And I hate the idea of the very special episode, but in a way, it's a very special episode, because our film for this episode is Blue Velvet from 1986, of course, directed by David Lynch. We are recording this podcast a few days after David Lynch's death, and we'll get into why it's an important film for us. Yes. As a couple. But tonight we watch it on VHS, getting it, I believe, from Pleasant Dreams. And the history of this particular tape is that it is the Wilsonville, Oregon, the former Wilsonville, Oregon Hollywood Video rental copy of Blue Velvet that somehow ended up in Pittsburgh.
And never across the country.
Yeah, somehow it has come across the country, possibly through the magic of Dusty at Pleasant Dreams. And we watched it tonight because we've been thinking a lot about
David Lynch.
Yeah. As a lot of people have. And I guess we should get into our connection to this film, our personal connection to this film. As a couple, we were roommates before we were a couple. It was mutual friends renting a house, and we needed an extra roommate, and I don't think we felt as though we had much in common. However, I rented Blue Velvet on VHS from Quick Flick Video in Ebensburg, Pennsylvania, near St. Francis's campus, and we watched it together, and maybe that was the first time we thought we had something in common, maybe. So we really bonded over Blue Velvet, of all films, which I had not seen before college.
I had seen it before.
And I had not seen it before the spring of 1997 production of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, which our director, Kenny Rosinski, who has been a mentor, was a mentor for us, and I still think about him a lot, who has also passed, actually borrowed a few visual elements from Blue Velvet in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. If you could imagine a college theater production of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory with visual elements from Blue Velvet in it.
I mean, as you do. The most obvious one is singing into the light.
The light, yes. There was a part, yes. And, yeah, he was like, I know where this is. And, he pointed to a picture of David Lynch, and I was like, I don't get it. He's like, you need to see Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
And so, boom, on it.
Now, yeah. I had actually seen Blue Velvet before, because I'm a bit of an insomniac when I was younger. And growing up in the Philadelphia area, there was just amazing late-night television, and Blue Velvet was one of the films. I'm actually typically a horror fan, and so it was on one of those channels that had usually great horror movies, and though there's definitely horror related to Blue Velvet, it's not traditionally classified as a horror film, but I had seen it before, and I think when we watched it together, it was almost like the secret handshake of like, oh, you liked it? I liked it. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
I think for me, especially growing up in a conservative Catholic family, and then now I look back now, I probably did have a couple friends in high school who might have been into the film, but we typically went to see films like When Harry Met Sally, and so to admit to your friends that you're like, I like this film Blue Velvet, just kind
or
of
or that you would want to share it with a friend who maybe wasn't ready for it.
Right.
We talk about the critical reception in its time.
Yeah.
And Blue Velvet was a controversial film in its time.
Yeah.
There's some indication that Lynch had at least the concept, if not a script, in the 1970s.
Yeah.
And really, there was a long road to making this film because of it, the violence, the sexuality in it, the aberrant, what would be considered the aberrant sexuality in it,
yeah.
You know, there's a way that you could very much, if you're a Hollywood producer, look at this script and say, can we get this as an R?
Yeah.
And if we can't get this as an R, the distribution possibilities for this film are pretty much done.
You know, and then... oddly, in a way that we were saying this as the film was going on, I think, you know, it's a neo noir is what I, you know, would have been the term.
Yeah,
neo noir.
Neo
noir at the time that they would have made that film. But you think it kind of opened the door for this kind of different take and almost violence. That happened,
yes.
We saw a lot in the 90s, like this darker take that we saw that happened in a lot of the 90s that has continued into now. So actually, if you watch it compared to some films today, it actually seems a bit more milder, like in the sense
In some ways it's milder. I think for me, the thing that will hit, still for a long time coming, will hit people strangely about this film is the sexuality in it.
Yeah.
And the sort of mixture of sex and anger and hatred and violence and pain.
Right.
That all of the characters... Well, the Kyle MacLachlan character, the Dennis Hopper character, and the Isabella Rossellini character all have... an interesting relationship to.
Mm-hmm.
It is also a film, you know, one of the things in the 1970s, there was that very famous, very generative Laura Mulvey essay, Visual Pleasure in Narrative Cinema,
mm-hmm.
where as a feminist film scholar, Mulvey argues that film teaches us how to look.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what happens in films is we watch men watching women.
Right.
And in that, we are taught how we are expected to look at women. And in a way, she argues... Well, not in a way. She argues that then, as a result, women are taught to see themselves mm-hmm. through this male-controlling gaze.
Right.
Which what this film does is... And I think where it's, for some people, probably quite disturbing... is that in a lot of ways our own voyeurism
mm-hmm.
and the way that a lot of us who I grew up in a, you know, we both grew up in towns that would love to be Lumberton.
Exactly, yes.
That aspire to be Lumberton.
Right.
But as kids, and the official story was that they were Lumberton, but as kids we knew better.
Right.
Or at least as teenagers we knew better. And I think that was a huge part of even the knowing about the underbelly of Loretto, Pennsylvania, this Catholic commune on top of a mountain in the 90s. Blue Velvet, A, plugs us totally into that. And B, the fact that, you know, everybody watched, well, not everybody, but a lot of people watched violent and sexy movies.
Yeah.
As a way of maybe exercising voyeurism. Like, I have this, you know...
It would have been, like, Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction.
I mean, there were just a lot of action films.
Right.
Slasher horror movies. All of that. And, you know, the back room in the mom-and-pop video store.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, here we are at... these moments of very disturbing sexuality. I mean, there's the famous scene in Blue Velvet where, and maybe we should do the plot summary real quick after this, where Kyle MacLachlan's character sneaks into Isabella Rossellini's apartment to get information on this ear that he finds in a field. He's home from college because his dad had a stroke, and he's walking home from the hospital and finds an ear and takes it to the police. And
as you do.
And then falls into this, like, amateur detective life.
It is like
into the Lumberton, very scary Lumberton underworld with Frank Booth as, you know, Dennis Hopper's Frank Booth, opening the world into these, like, really fringe characters. And there's a scene where Kyle MacLachlan's character breaks into her apartment And she comes home, and next thing you know, Dennis Hopper's there, and they have really weird, violent sex.
Yeah.
And there's so many point of view shots. We're looking at Kyle MacLachlan looking through the blinds in the closet door, and next thing you know, we are looking through the closet door. The yeah. blinds of the closet door, and our gaze is his gaze as we are watching this horror, this somewhat horrifying scene, which is actually the first scene they shot.
Wow.
For the film, yeah. Sometimes film productions do that. If you have a very rough scene or a scene that involves nudity, you get it out of the way first so that it doesn't loom over the production, or perhaps in some cases so that the actress can't, you know, negotiate her way out of it. The Room did this as well, actually. The first scene that they shot of The Room was Tommy Wiseau and Juliet Danielle going at it all day. It was an all-day shoot. Oh. And then the second day was supposed to be another sex scene all-day shoot. And she was like, no, I'm not doing that again.
Yeah.
Anyway, you don't have leverage. You know, we've shot almost all of my scenes in this film. Now we're going to do this scene. Yeah. And if you want me to do this, I need more money, or I'm not doing the scene or whatever. So that is the first day, first shot of the film, of the film, was the closet sequence.
And so you actually think it's really interesting because we actually don't see it from the point of view of Dennis Hopper or Frank Booth. We're actually not seeing what he's seeing or asking her to do.
Yes.
So actually, it's also in some ways, it's worse because you don't fully understand right away what he's doing to her or trying to do to her.
Yes.
And so it's much more disturbing. It's almost like your imagination is worse with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, again, this, I think, meta commentary on...
Well, actually, I was just reading, David Lynch said he had to recut the scene to get an R rating.
Oh, wow.
And so they had to take a couple things out. So you see Kyle MacLachlan's reaction to what's happening. And he said in some ways that reaction is worse because you don't know what was done to her. So it's like that we all know and understand Frank is a dangerous man and is capable of really harming her. And so in that moment, you're just... You don't really necessarily fully know what he has done to her.
Yeah, which again, makes it, again, and it's disturbed because we are already at that point in the film. We should have been bonded to the Kyle MacLachlan character as our lead, as our hero, as our clean-cut, all-American college kid.
He's also like a Hardy Boy, right? Like he's, yes. You know, that might be a really old reference. He's almost like Fred from Scooby-Doo. Maybe that's a better reference.
Yes. That's also an old reference. Yeah. Not as old, but yeah.
But he's clean cut. He's smart. He's a college boy. And he's
who takes time off because his family needs him.
Yeah, his father. Because his father's in the hospital. And he's going to solve this, determined to solve this crime. But that scene, because he... You can tell he's almost deriving some pleasure from it.
Yes.
You kind of start questioning him.
Him and us. And yeah.
Like, he doesn't look away. He watches what is happening to her. Doesn't intervene. Watches what happens to her. Doesn't look away from what is happening to her. And you get like Frank Booth being so violent of maybe why he hesitated to help
her. There is then fear and sexuality and you then begin to question if there's an element of jealousy in there. I mean, he has already seen her naked before Frank Booth shows up. So I think, you know, watching this film in 2025 now, one of the things I want to think about is, like, this, you know, the reaction that so many people we know have had, especially on our social media feeds the last few days, about the passing of David Lynch, is, for me, that appeal part of the appeal, I think, especially for people of our vintage, of the sort of Gen X, and I think more sort of astute friends who are maybe, we have a lot of millennial friends at this point, is that it does deconstruct that sort of American myth of the small town, innocent Andy Griffith show, Donald Reed, you know, show, father knows best, suburban life, and that no matter what you try to do, there is this darkness, there is this undercurrent in the world, no matter where you are. And you can choose to believe the myth, but that's not how the world works. And I think for me and for a lot of people, the art of David Lynch, because you even think the way like Twin Peaks, I mean, we have friends who this time of year, we have several friends this time of year who rewatch Twin Peaks starting around now.
Yeah.
It's a January, February project. And again, Who Killed Laura Palmer? Again, small town, it's now the Pacific Northwest. But
Kyle MacLachlan in both.
And what is that undercurrent?
Yeah.
What is that thing that you know about of the adult world that is evil and the problem of evil? And, you know, for this movie to come out in 1986, we're second term of Reagan. You know, he loved that Puritan phrase of the shining city on the hill, the America that is where, you know, problems are overseas. That's Russia. That's the old world. And we've come here and we've won.
Yeah.
In a sense, just by being here. And I think there are still a lot of Americans politically who that's how they see us, or they're somehow trying to get back to this mythic status. But plenty of us know better.
Yeah. Well, you think about, like, he finds the ear while he's, like, tossing stones in a field. He's, like, walking along, tossing stones.
And that
stones.
Field has a field full of garbage.
Field full of garbage and a human, severed human ear with it. But, you know, even before that, the beginning scene with his father watering his lovely garden in his beautiful suburban neighborhood, he does have the stroke. He actually falls into a mud puddle and is, like, you know, is wallowing the mud puddle. The dog starts jumping on him to get the water. And then you kind of go into the grass and you see, look like darkling beetles. In the grass. And like and then the ear had like ants on them. And so he automatically, like right away, just lets you know with that beetle scene that we actually don't fully understand what's going on in the world around us. And just opens that path for it.
Which is a weird thing to say, but, you know, for a film that is surrealistic, that has scenes that feel like fever dreams, that has really interesting sort of fringy characters.
Yeah.
I mean, bordering on cartoonish. I mean, this was, you know, Frank Booth was the character that Dennis Hopper was born to play.
100%.
And he could not overcook it, no matter. There's no way he could be mawkish.
Yeah.
Because there's no overcooking that, his performance of that as that character.
Yeah.
In a weird way.
He took it really seriously.
He did take it very seriously.
Yeah.
So I think for a lot of folks, as surreal as this film is, it is a vision of a truth.
Yeah.
And I think that truth, it's not just that it's a weird movie that's interesting to look at, but I think the impact of David Lynch for so many people is that he was maybe holding up a mirror to our society.
Yeah.
And he was exposing a truth, even if there are times where we did not fully understand that truth.
Yeah.
And there is a way in a lot of people's high school education teaches them to look for symbols.
Yeah.
You can really get bogged down in everything David Lynch has ever done. and think, oh, that's a symbol. There is a secret message. Where, you know, it's, I think it's a much more interesting way of watching these films to look at that big picture.
Yeah.
And to look at ourselves in that big picture.
I think, you know, we're coming also from, I think more so now than in the past, of this, like, if there's something bad that's happening in a home, no one talks about it.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, okay, that family, we just don't discuss it. Like, that's that, you know. And so it could be, it could very much be, you know, the minister of the neighborhood who could potentially be beating his wife and family at night. But no one, you would never talk about it, right? Because it's like what happened behind closed doors is what happens behind closed doors. And I think that that very much David Lynch would have grown up in that kind of
era. I mean, in one way, a lot of people said that, you know, David Lynch, in one way, he skipped the counterculture of the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
He stayed always in a... He always maybe had one foot in the 1950s.
Well, and I think, you know, it's like actually him and John Waters in that sense. Because John Waters, in a much more silly way, really did kind of examine that, what does it mean to be like a proper family, but actually like... the reality of it could be very, for John Waters, very dirty, you know?
Yeah.
But for David Lynch, he's like, oh no, there's a darkness that can definitely exist in a community, in a family, in a neighborhood. And he was exploring that. And he was exploring that, like, beyond these well-manicured lawns, other things could be happening.
Yeah.
And that there is violence that's happening within the community. There's drug use that can happen within a community. And he just he kind of exposes that.
Yeah.
And I think for Jeffrey, who bright-eyed, young college kid, seems to have a really nice family, it's an awakening for him to the reality that's out there. And he kind of takes Sandy along the way. Which actually, in watching it this time, I'm like, poor Sandy. Because he's just like, he's so comfortable being like, okay, Sandy, can you take me to that play? Can you take me to that apartment building where she lives? Sandy, can you do this for me? He kind of is happily pulling her into potentially dangerous situations. And she's like 17, 18.
She's still in high school.
She's still in high school. But I think it is, I think it just, in many ways... reaffirms that we truly don't know our neighbors. We truly don't know what is happening.
Which, you know, and whenever something does happen in one of those communities, oh, it can't happen here. This is, you know, there are places in the American imagination where those things are supposed to happen.
Right.
And they're urban and non-white. And yet,
Yeah.
And so there is also the interesting thing, the last scene of the film, the mechanical robin.
Yeah.
Which...
Eating the Darkling Beetle.
Slavoj Žižek has this fun interpretation of it that, in a sense, you know, Carl McLaughlin's character, Jeffrey, wakes up. You know, they see these mechanical robins, and then they're watching the mechanical robin from the kitchen. And what Žižek is saying is, you know, that's very self-consciously supposed to be a fake-looking bird, which it is.
Yeah.
And that is the point, is that the normal waking above-ground world of America is the fantasy.
Yeah.
And that Blue Velvet exposes the reality.
Yeah.
And again, for our generation, for a generation of, you know, and, you know, it's interesting, the addition of this VHS tape, is it's the front of the MGM Contemporary Classics line, you know, has that emblazoned on the box.
Yeah.
You know, this is an amazing entryway into art house cinema.
Yeah.
This is an amazing, I think for a lot of people, David Lynch films, because they were just mainstream enough, and Twin Peaks was on the ABC network.
Right, because Twin
that
Peaks
he opened been, that door for a lot of people look at other kinds of visual culture.
Well, you think a lot of
other kinds of art.
You think like that sense of, like, you know, a lot of people say it's the golden age of television. And there's a lot, you know, a lot of prestige series that owe a lot to David Lynch and Twin Peaks. The interesting thing about this is, like, so you have Eraserhead, and then he went from Eraserhead to Elephant Man, which...
Yeah.
My goodness. I don't know if I ever can watch that film again, just because it's so...
Yeah.
Heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Beautiful film. He got a ton of accolades for Elephant Man. And then Dune flopped. It was, like, no one liked Dune. It went really, really horrible. And so, like, Blue Velvet was him coming back from Dune. And so I think, like, Blue Velvet is actually, for me, the one... that you see the aesthetic that he really develops in those themes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so you see, like, the red curtains, for example, the use of, like, that going in closely to lights and things. Like, so you see these, like, markers of David Lynch that start in Blue Velvet consistently. Like, you know, of course, with Eraserhead, some of that stuff was in Eraserhead, but it feels like he's like, oh, this is my visual style.
Yeah.
That comes again through his other films and through the TV series.
Twin Peaks.
That you see with it. So it's kind of interesting. It's like there's that before Blue Velvet and then after Blue Velvet that happens. And I think you're right. Like, he can be an accessible art house. You know, The Straight Story actually is really highly accessible to many people, right? But he is an accessible art house and does know how to kind of push boundaries, but not push it too far to frighten away a lot of people.
Well, Inland Empire.
Well, that is true. That is true. But we'll say that was much later in his career.
was much later in his career. So, yeah. So, the five big questions, I guess, it's time for that.
Yeah.
Well, I think the first one is easy. Is it camp, retro, classic, or just an old movie? It is absolutely a classic.
I mean,
the box is right. It is a contemporary classic. Though, contemporary is going on 40 years ago pretty soon. Next year will be 40 years ago.
you know, it's definitely a classic. It's a cult classic. You know, though it got accolades when it was released, it wasn't well loved.
Yeah.
But over time, I think actually, you know, there's also readiness for things, and I don't think people were ready for Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
And, like, looking back now, and I think people are like, oh, Blue Velvet. And I think you look at, I was actually just reading, and they're like, if you look at some of the other films that were nominated for Academy Awards, Blue Velvet is the one that really has stood the test of time.
Yeah.
I mean, Top Gun got nominated for Best Song. Like, you know, like, that was the year of Top Gun as well.
Yeah.
And looking at it.
Yeah.
It's definitely a cult classic. It's a beautiful film. I think most people who are interested in film start with Blue Velvet. You know, you kind of...
Yeah, and it is a film that was meant to live in home video.
Yeah.
I mean, you think before, and you think... But really, if you want to think of the home video revolution, starting in this country around 1982...
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, mainstreams. I think my family got a VCR in 1987. You know, it's a film that found its audience...
100%. And I think that's also, like, the hard part about losing physical stores to go rent movies in, because you would have found that on the shelf, right? And you would have seen it and be like, oh, I thought I heard people talk about this film. Where now, like, just the algorithms wouldn't have ever come into
a movie for you.
Right.
And I think that's the other thing, for us as young people... For a lot of our friends as young people, David Lynch was the thing that...
Yeah.
The gateway drug. The threshold that you passed through that was... like, how many doors... You know, and it was Friday night in Loretto or something.
Yeah.
And got it from Quick Flick. And, I remember seeing this film. I mean, how many times have we rewatched this film, revisited this film... Back when the Oaks used to do...
Yeah.
The Oaks Theater in Oakmont was this beautiful 1936 cinema palace sort of thing. modest Simnon Palace. It was the Depression, but really cool, cool movie theater.
They had an amazing programmer for the longest time.
Amazing programmer, and they had a summer series called Moonlit Matinees, which they would start at midnight, and you would go as a midnight movie. And I remember being so jazzed that year when the schedule came out, and I looked at it in the paper. I was like, "Oh, Blue Velvet! We're gonna go see Blue Velvet at midnight with a room with a fully packed house full of strangers," and it was the coolest thing ever. And so many people were so excited to see this film on the big screen.
And you know, and I think David Lynch is still one of those people that, if as you're first getting into film, people are like, "Oh, you got to check out."
Yeah, David you got to get out. You will. And that's going to be for a very long time to come. So, speaking of 40 years in the future, question two, what about the social political distance?
You know, the funny thing is, as we were watching it, I was like, oh man, thin ties. No one wears thin ties. And shoulder pads.
Like. I mean, that is a thing. You know, I just saw the New York Times poll today that, you know, something like 80-90% of America. I mean, one thing that has different, and I wonder about how young people would encounter, how my students would encounter this film now. You know, 80-some percent of Americans believe that the system is broken. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, what's the Leonard Cohen line? Everybody knows the dice are loaded.
Yeah.
That was not the case so much. It was an edgy truth in 1986,
yeah,
or 1997 when we watched this movie together.
Yeah,
it's less so now.
Yeah,
you know, which either makes it truer than true, and I think a lot of the Gen X thing is you grew up in this quote unquote wholesome environment and you wanted to get away from that. I mean, we've lived our entire adult lives in a city.
Yes.
By choice.
Yes.
Though
oddly much nicer than the neighborhood I grew up in.
Yeah, and I think in a lot of ways much nicer than the neighborhood I grew up in too, which was part of, you know, like the myth. Ha ha.
Yeah.
You know, whereas now I think a lot of my young people just hope they have some of that peace and that domestic life, and they're not sure they're ever going to have it.
Yeah.
Which is different. I do wonder about some of the violence in terms of actually sexual violence.
Yeah.
How that lands for people now, because it is disturbing, especially in this kind of very dirty voyeuristic way.
Yeah.
Where we are watching and we watch Kyle MacLachlan's Jeffrey character get sucked into it, and maybe he enjoys it too. Maybe yeah. Maybe there's a little Frank Booth.
Well, Frank Booth actually even says it to him, "You're like me."
Yeah.
In that one scene. Yep.
All right. Question three. What about that technical distance of other effects or living technology?
So the funny thing about it is that it's definitely like, you know, it's the 80s, but they're driving cars from like the 60s. Like,
yeah.
So you definitely can tell.
Yeah.
It's old timey, right? Like you can tell.
Yeah.
It took place at a different time. Definitely no computers, no cell phones. Like you have to use a landline to get a hold of people.
Yes.
Cops are using walkie talkies. Like,
yeah,
there's you definitely know that there is a distance there.
Yeah,
that's happening. You think now today, if this film was made, he'd be an internet sleuth who's like googling all this stuff.
Yeah, or you know, instead of her honking four times when he's in the apartment, it would just get a text.
Right. Right, and he'd be like hacking into like the apartment building cameras
to see what's happening. And
so like that, it would have been a different film today.
Yeah.
I still think it's an amazing
It would have
film.
To be a very
it
different film.
It would have
film,
to be but, a very different film.
But and like I said, I think, you know, unlike the shark from Jaws, it's supposed to look bad.
Yeah.
The Robin at the end is supposed to look bad.
Yeah.
But you think the other camera work, the camera going into the grass in the first sequence,
yeah,
the close-up of the ants devouring the ear.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah.
I mean, that ear is such a good-looking ear. Question four. What was it like to watch this film on VHS? Well, I will say our former rental copy is pretty knackered, actually. I had to wrestle with the tracking a little bit, or I tried. It was auto tracking. Do we try manual tracking? Do we track up? Do we track down? There was a lot of the top of the screen kind of was a little bendy. That top inch of our TV screen was a little bendy, which
very
in
grainy.
In the scene when they're going on the night ride with Frank, and the yellow line is coming through the camera, that was a little distracting.
Yeah,
but
well, it was also really grainy, and so the night shots at time could be any dark or night shots could be were really rough.
Yeah, maybe we need to get this on Laserdisc.
Maybe I was hoping we had on Laserdisc.
me too. Me too, actually.
So I mean, that's the hard part about VHS. It does after so many viewings start.
Yeah,
to really...
and yeah, this was again a well-loved rental copy that made its way across the country to us. Man, Hollywood Video. I mean, yes, the mom and pop video store was more important and better and more interesting. But man, Hollywood Video. There was something nice about going to Hollywood Video.
Yeah.
I liked Hollywood Video.
Me too.
So, last question. Question five. Will we ever watch this movie again?
I mean, we've seen this movie a ton, so I can't imagine us never, ever not watching this again.
No, I actually made myself really sad when I was writing up the notes for this, thinking about the Oaks and Moonlit Matinees. And man, wouldn't it be cool if this summer, though we're old now and watching a 2-hour and 10-minute movie that started at midnight, would be kind of rough for the rest of our week. Or the entire summer, if it was a great schedule. But man, wouldn't it be great to go to the Oaks and watch Blue Velvet?
Because, you know, we would do times where we'd go see that and then wake up early to go see Bach, Beethoven, and Brunch.
Yeah.
Yes, those were rough. Those were rough times.
Yeah.
Especially in Bach, Beethoven, and Brunch was longer series, too. So
oh,
there was a lot more.
They really overlap for weeks and weeks and weeks. It'd just be going into the week groggy. Like, man.
It was
rough weekend. And it was like, oh, yeah, what do? We went to the movie and the classical music concert at the park. But which is maybe our Lumberton lives.
How nerdy are we that we're like, well, we went to late night film festival and then we went to listen to classical music. I think, you know,
in a picnic in a park.
In a picnic in a park. On an old, actually, like, steel mill barons, like, former lands.
Former estate,
Former estate. And it's beautiful. You know, Frank Booth is such a disturbing character, right? And I think, and Frank Booth has so gone into kind of the universe and, you know, even if you don't know it, you know it. Like, you know some of his lines, you know.
Yeah, so, and that reminds me, actually, my first exposure to anything Blue Velvet, and I didn't know what it was, and I probably didn't realize until maybe the second time I saw it, the first Mr. Bungle album.
Mm.
The self-titled Mr. Bungle album has sound bites from
this movie.
From this movie in it.
Yeah.
Which, again, further cemented its Gen X counterculture status. And I was like, what is these sounds? What is this line about drinking warm beer and it makes him puke? And who is that? And I think the second time I watched the movie, oh my God, that's Mr. Bungle!
It was a dangerous film at the time, right? So, like, actually, Dennis Hopper wasn't the first actor approached to do it. Like, Harry Dean Stanton, who worked with him... a lot in the future with David Lynch in the future, didn't want to do it. Molly Ringwald was actually approached to play Sandy, which actually would have been pretty amazing to see her in that role.
But that great reaction shot when her mouth just curves downward and she's so horrified.
She realizes that he had that Jeffrey has been sleeping with Dorothy. You know, this film, as you said in the beginning, you know. And I've said it before, we're the first generation of massive divorce. And in that massive divorce, a lot of dirty laundry was aired.
Was aired, and a lot of friends' houses who, you know, had absentee parents and had the parents that were absentee and there was not a lock on the liquor cabinet and they really didn't care because they were out living their lives and they got their lives back and who cared what their 16-year-old was doing while they weren't home. All of that. I mean, I remember the first time I went to a party at a friend's house whose parents were gone every weekend.
Yeah.
And there was crazy stuff happening. And in a weird way, actually, I felt like even tonight watching it, when Jeffrey is exposed to the Frank Booth world and they go over to Harry Dean Stanton's apartment.
Yeah.
And I was like, I've been in that apartment. I remember that feeling of being sort of horrified, but also like, damn. Because I've been in that apartment.
Not to be grim, but on the other side of it, from like a woman perspective, you know, how many families did we find out that the father was beating the mother?
Yeah.
And she felt like she didn't need to be in that situation anymore.
Yeah.
Where in the 70s, 60s, you know, 50s, it would have just been...
You made a hard bed and you're laying in it.
And so it was like, oh, wow. Like, you're like, oh, wait. Like, oh, that's why your parents are getting divorced. Oh, your father was beating your mother. Oh, you know, like that kind of thing. And so I think this like kind of really reveals that. And I know the violence that you do see against Dorothy is really horrific, but it's also how many women were experiencing that type of violence and had no way out of that violence, which is what's happening to Dorothy in that moment in time. Now, it's because Frank is holding her child and husband captive, but how many other women felt captive because of
finances, the inability to even sign a lease.
Exactly. Right. You couldn't have your own money.
Couldn't have your own bank account. Couldn't have your own credit card.
And so I think...
And, yeah.
I think this film definitely exposes an ugliness that's there and an ugliness that we're willing to ignore, right? So that, you know, she has that line about, and the robins came and they brought love, and just like how hokey that line is, but how many people ignore what happens around them just so that they can have their
hokey
robins of love moment.
Yeah.
So I think that it's just for me, it's always had a very profound effect on me. And I grew up in a neighborhood that had, you know, gang activity and drug deals and all this other stuff. But at least it was in Chester, right? That's always Chester.
At least it was in Plainfield. We live in South Plainfield, which is so much better and so much more wholesome and so much less terrifying.
Yes. But you knew what was going down on the street. So this is a film that, for our relationship-wise, is important to us, but also it's just a very important film in general. I also don't know what that says about us that we realized that we had a connection after watching Blue Velvet together. So I don't know what that says about us as a couple. We're not going to get into the psychology of that.
No, I think that's a good note to end on. I think, watch Blue Velvet if you haven't seen Blue Velvet.
Check it out.
Bye.
Bye.